Holly. It's Holly. Evie.
You guys think that? All right, let's begin. If there's some extra over here in case not everybody got. We have a couple of introductions. First, on a global level, I'll talk about the TUOL. Tomorrow, I'll talk about the TUOL for Wednesday. We're trying, even though we started just a couple of weeks ago, but there is a process to our shiurim b'siurim. You know, it's like, as you notice, we already had two shiurim, as far as, we had three shiurim already. If you remember a long time ago when Rabbi Liebtag gave a general overview to the topography of Eretz Yisrael and understanding some of the events in Tanakh based upon understanding of the map. Since then, we've had overviews on Sefer Yoshua and on Sefer Shoftim, and that's going to continue. We're going to work our way through overviews on the different Sfarim that we find in Tanakh, and thus we also will try to hit different places on our Tiulim that relate back to those that which we've learned in Tanakh. That's the general idea, and you've been seeing how it's starting to pan out. There's a challenge, like we'll be talking about the end of the Sifrei, the Nevi'im, and we'll get pretty much to the destruction of the Bayit Rishon. And then afterwards, we'll get some historian, we'll come in and talk about Bayit Sheni. We'll see how much time we have for that. After Pesach, we'll fill in talking about, Zionism and get some lectures on that as well. There's a great challenge. There's a lot of time. We don't have time in the end. There's a lot of history that, so to speak, goes from, let's say, after Choron Bayit Sheni or after the closing of the Mishnah, all the way up just to about the time that Zionism is going to begin. So like, let's say from about the years of 200 or so, 300, 400, any time around there, all the way up until right about the 1800s, that's a whole chunk of time. And it would be nice as far as our Shiurim V'Sirim program to have, like, you know, trying to, you have to, like, sort of sort through things and peg them and keep the chronology. But we thought it would be appropriate for us to be able to have some feeling, understanding of what happened actually in Eretz Yisrael during that time as well, even though there was after the Korban Bayit, but as far as Jewish communities here in Eretz Yisrael until the time that people started coming back in mass, the time of right at the beginning of the Zionism. So it's like an impossible challenge, an impossible task almost, to be able to give over about 1,600 years worth of Jewish history in a short one lesson. But our guest today is very much up to that challenge, and he's graciously agreed to come in to speak. I'd just like to introduce Mr. Sam Kapustin, who's also known as my brother-in-law. You guys, he's probably known as Mr. Sam Kapustin. Mr. Kapustin is the Jewish Studies Principal of the Tannenbaum Community High School at Toronto, the Chat School, Mira's, the Chat School being famous because of Mira, and Mr. Kapustin has led that school as the Jewish Studies Principal for many, many years. I've kept it on a good course, and is now, along with my sister Marsha, just walked out. I don't know where she went. This was her golden moment. But who are now, after many years of service to the Toronto community, the Gadol, as well as specifically to the community high school, they will be making Aliyah this summer. B'Shara Tova Mutzlacha. I'm looking forward to that very much. And if there's any person visiting right now, Mr. Kapustin is actually interviewing Shlichim for next year, and he's really jumping from place to place, and he's very gracious in giving of his time to be able to come here in the morning to address us. So we're very thankful for that. And again, if there's anybody who's up to the challenge to be able to give over a understanding of what took place in Eretz Yisrael during those periods of time, it would be Mr. Kapustin. So thank you very much.
Boker Tov,
everyone. Among the many impossible tasks that my brother-in-law has given me over the years, this is just one, okay? It's not the only. Although this is probably one of the more enjoyable ones, to be sure. I did this a couple years ago, and it was a lot of fun, and hopefully as well this morning. The task that he has given me, as he briefly outlined, is to talk about the land of Israel from about the 3rd to the 18th century, mere 1600 years. Therefore, first let me say at the outset that I don't like lecturing, which is what I'm doing right now. What I like is feedback, okay? So if you, hopefully, will have some questions, then by all means in the middle, you know, we're going to look at some mikorot. Talking to me, that would be a good idea. Okay, also gives me a chance to breathe, which is very important. I'll just say once, Amira knows, she suffered through a year with me, so she is aware of you know, the way I try to do things. Okay, so let me tell you what I will do, and more importantly, what I will not do in the time allotted. I will not give a detailed history or even a survey of the period that we're talking about, but I will try to give you a bit of a snapshot of some of the important themes, not so much events, but some of the important themes that should speak to us today and therefore emphasize the importance of Eretz Yisrael for the Jewish people. In the process, I will address some of the myths and misconceptions that you know, are common in people's understanding of Jewish history and which can sometimes lead us a bit astray, and no less in this case. I want to relate to something that Reb Baruch said at the very beginning, namely that in this series that you are having, you're having somebody who's going to talk about Bayit Sheni, and you're going to have somebody who's talking about the modern period, Zionism, etc., and somewhere in the middle we're sort of squeezing in this large period of time, which raises the question as to why we generally approach the medieval period, and I'll use the term medieval in a general sense here, in terms of Eretz Yisrael, such a if you will, reflect the less importance of it. Certainly, we are concerned about that period, but it is far removed from us, not only in time, but also in terms of the way people live and their attitudes. But if it is such, it is, has importance, why do we spend more time in perhaps in Bayit Sheni and on the modern period in Zionism than the medieval one? That's one thing I think we should keep in mind as we're going along here. There are various aspects to answering that issue. First of all, it is true that few Jews live in the land of Israel in this period. Some would suggest that there were periods when there were no Jews living in the land of Israel, which is quite possible. But certainly the vast majority of Jews lived outside the land of Israel, whether it was in the Middle East and later on in Europe, wherever. The most important thing is that the major events affecting Jewish history took place outside the land of Israel during the Middle Ages, and therefore we naturally don't, you know, focus on it all that much. But another issue which I think is important is that in the last 100 or 150 years, as we have become involved in Zionism and returned to the land of Israel, there has been a tendency to look at those periods which people more identify with. After all, Land of Israel, Medinat Yisrael, we've established a state. When was the last time we had a state? Not in the Middle Ages, but rather in Bayit Sheni. So it's natural to look at that period, and of course the period that leads more immediately to the establishment of the state today, and therefore sort of skip over the Middle Ages. For all those reasons, and some that are justified, that's why that is, but I think we should not forget certain things in that period. And at heart, and by training, I'm a medievalist, so therefore I'm a little prejudiced anyway. All right. It is a large period, and as I said, I'm not going to talk about names or dates. But I do want to talk about some, as I said, some of the issues. First of all, in the handout that I gave you, okay, which we will follow along, it lists, first of all, the names and approximate dates of various nations that ruled the land of Israel. In all of those times, frankly, the land that they ruled encompassed a much greater area than the height of the rule of the Jewish people in the land of Israel, which was probably the time of David and Shlomo, and all of these empires essentially encompassed the land of Israel and other areas in the Middle East. They were not particularly interested, any of these empires, in the land of Israel per se. It had no special kedushah for them. Why were they interested in the land of Israel, do you think? What is the importance for, let us say, the Roman Empire or Alexander the Great? What would be interested, yes?
Because it was a bridge between the north and the south.
It was a bridge between, correct, Asia and Africa, correct? Right?
Very good.
Okay. Whoever. It was. Therefore, the land of Israel was sort of incidental, so to speak. It was not of importance per se, but rather is geographic. Antiochus, right, the bad guy in the Hanukkah story, did conquer Israel, but he did so because he was worried about Egypt, and he spent most of his time fighting in Egypt. So that's the main issue. Yes, go ahead.
What about the Crusades?
The Crusades, you're right. They were interested in the land of Israel per se, obviously not for Jewish reasons, but for Christian reasons. They were also interested, however, for good political and economic reasons. Namely, it was Christianity and Islam, right? So this was to get a holding, so to speak, in the world of Islam. There was a tension between them. There, yes, for religious Christian reasons, they were interested in land of Israel. So that would be, any mendation, I accept that. Good. Okay. Now this, however, clashes again with our idea that the central place in the world, so to speak, is the land of Israel. And if one believes that, certainly on religious terms, that's certainly justified as far as Judaism is concerned, but we shouldn't sometimes let that lead us astray in terms of political and economic terms. The United States is not interested primarily in the land of Israel, except as it relates to the interests of the United States, and that would be true of any other country. They don't have our attachment, if you will, to the land of Israel, and we should not expect them to have that attachment. No different than it was in medieval times or ancient times, in terms of the way the great power, so to speak, of their times looked at the land of Israel. So we have to stand back, if you will, and appreciate that. There was, of course, a belief in the Mashiach after the Churban, but it was, for the most part, certainly after Bar Kokhba. If I'm mentioning names or periods or whatever that are not familiar, please ask about it. After the Bar Kokhba, 135, the belief in the Mashiach in terms of immediate political redemption for the Jewish people decreases. Right? It is de-emphasized, even probably intentionally, by the Tanaim. It is not quite as important, although, as we'll see, certainly it maintained there. So the Jews had to accept the fact they are a minority, they're going to be a minority, and they're not going to be returning anytime soon to the land of Israel to establish their own state. Whether they were a minority under the Muslims or under the Christians, it didn't really make that much difference in terms of this issue of returning. Okay. Now, if we turn a page, we have a series of maps. And you'll note the numbering of the pages, hopefully clearly. And the purpose of including these is just to emphasize this point that Israel is incidental. Okay, none of the empires, certainly in the Middle Ages and even earlier, looked to the geographical area of the land of Israel. They connected it with something else or other. And you can see the administrative divisions, whether it's the right side or the left side of the map, under the Muslims, that they included it in some other area, right? It was included administratively with something else. The land of Israel per se did not have any particular importance to them, and it was divided up, again, for mainly political reasons. That's the way colonial powers tended to do so into the 19th and even into the 20th century, which is why we have various problems. But so also it was in the Middle Ages. Turning the page over, number two, you see the height of the Crusader kingdom. And again, there they were, of course, interested in the land of Israel, as has been pointed out, but not for Jewish reasons, obviously. And again, there were various areas of the land of Israel, Eretz Yisrael, which we would view as holy, which of course was not included because it was not important to them. They were interested in the Christian holy places, and those are the ones that they tried to retain. We see also from the maps that there are all kinds of names in Arabic, in Latin, sometimes in Greek, sometimes in Hebrew, and someone may have said, particularly in Bayit Sheni, that this was a name of a place today known as and in Arabic it is what? We have to be sensitive that the land of Israel has been conquered and occupied and lived in by all kinds of groups, and therefore their language and what they've left, if you will, in terms of the names of places, are still with us. And that's also part of Eretz Yisrael. Indeed, the important cities of Eretz Yisrael were not the ones that we look at necessarily today. Places like Ramla, Gaza, Hebron, Tiberia, they were major centers during this period, not only for non-Jews, but also for Jews, many of them. And again, we wouldn't necessarily look at them as major centers today. Things have changed, again, for these various reasons. And lastly, in terms of the maps, I just included a few maps from Yerushalayim to emphasize that point, and you've all spent perhaps most time in Yerushalayim as well as any other city in Israel. And I think you're aware that if you go 10 feet, almost anywhere in Yerushalayim, certainly in the eastern part of Yerushalayim, that you can't help but running into Jewish, Christian, Muslim, whatever, remnants, okay? And sometimes all in the same place. There actually is not one Yerushalayim. There are a number of Yerushalayims. It'd be nice if they were neatly layered one after the other. That's not always the case. But again, even going by the street signs, we can see that there are different periods. So when we walk, we can't help but walking through Jewish history when we walk through Yerushalayim. It's one of the things that I love to do. When I walk through Yerushalayim, it's not just David HaMelech, who, you know, was there, but, you know, there were, Salah Adin was there, and other people, not to compare those two, but nonetheless, the history is overwhelming. And the more one knows about that history, of course, the more meaningful it is. So, we have a Byzantine, those are the Christians, the Crusaders. Again, if you've gone to the old cities, I'm sure everyone has, you appreciate the differences. We may not be totally happy that there are Christian monasteries or other Christian institutions, but that's part of the history of Yerushalayim. And lastly, and page 5, from the later Muslim period, let's say from 13th century until the 20th century, again, various divisions of Yerushalayim which reflect this Muslim presence. It's not just historical. In other words, it's with us today. And if we relate to whether it's Yerushalayim per se or whether it's Israel as a whole, we have to relate to the fact that it has importance not only for us, but others as well. And that's, again, a reality. That's a reality of the land of Israel, which the state of Israel sometimes has to take into account. Okay, number 6 is another map, but it's a map of a different sort. And you may have seen it. This is where it says document number 1. You may have seen it in various places. I think there's a model of it in the Yeretika. It's at the Israel Museum. A map from the city in Jordan called Madeba or Madaba. And if you hold the map this way, okay, there is north to south. And that long line in the middle is the Cardo. Everyone familiar with the Cardo? Okay. This was originally a Roman, the main street of Yerushalayim during, after Korban. And this again is, let's say, 6th century. So as long as, before the Muslims came, it was the main street of the city. Therefore the center of Jewish. What do you see on the Cardo today if you go there? What do you see there? What does it look like? You walk down the street. What is on either side? You remember? Pardon?
There are columns.
Okay, there are columns that held up, that's true, various things. But on either side, there are openings for stores. Okay? Which means that it was the commercial center of Yerushalayim at that time. Which was not the same as was true in Bayit Sheni. Where were the stores, so to speak, located in Bayit Sheni in time of Beit HaMikdash?
By Har
HaBayit. By the Har HaBayit. Okay? If you go into the excavation there, you'll see that, you know, that's where the people bought the Yonim for the Korbanot, etc., etc., right? So, in a different rule, center is changed because the Christians weren't so much interested in the Har HaBayit. What were they interested in? What was the holy site for them? Church of the Holy Sepulchre, because what's there? According to Christian tradition, right? That's where Jesus was killed. Okay, so and buried there. So therefore, that's the important. So the history affects how the city evolved. Okay. Now let's talk a little bit about Jews in Eretz Israel during this period. Again, we're talking about from 13th century until the 3rd century until about the 18th. Yes.
How is there a church with his burial if they believe that he came back to life?
Now we're moving from history to, if you will, theology. Okay, the belief that Jesus came back to life, right? Whether he was buried in some sort of cave, all right, and then he, according to the New Testament, at least one of the books of the New Testament, that he came back to life. There's not an essential contradiction in that, all right? He was buried, and then something supernatural, if you will, happened. And he came back to life. What happened afterwards is a different issue. Okay, but the he went up to heaven, according to Christian tradition. But the burial, or more exactly, the killing of Jesus, right, the crucifixion of Jesus, was supposed to have happened in that place. That, according to Christian theology, then came back to life doesn't contradict per se that he was killed. He was killed there, which was at that time outside the wall of Yerushalayim, because you didn't want to have bodies inside. Why didn't you want to have bodies inside? Why didn't you want to kill people inside the walls of Yerushalayim? Some of the dead he is Tamei, right? That would be a problem for anybody who was in the city, right? So therefore that was the place where the Romans killed people, right? And by the way, crucifixion was a normal way in which the Romans killed enemies. And generally probably looked at Jesus as a political enemy, not so much as a religious enemy, the two sort of combined. What did they call him? King of the Jews. King of the Jews meant that he was going to lead, in their view, a resurrection, insurrection against the Romans. That maybe was not his intent, it's a different issue. Okay. So at any rate, that's why that church was built there, and again, at that time, was outside. Okay. Excuse me. Now, the Romans were pagans, and then they become Christians in the 4th century, and eventually the Roman Empire is divided. We have an Eastern Empire and a Western Empire, and the Eastern Empire was based in what today we call Constantinople. What's that called today, that city?
Istanbul,
capital, not the capital, the major city in Turkey, but at that time it was called Byzantium. So the Christians ruled there, called Byzantine Christians. And Eretz Israel was part of their empire, okay?
Western or Eastern?
Eastern, okay? So therefore, because Yerushalayim and Eretz Israel was holy, they therefore ruled it according to Christian ideology. We know, therefore, if I had a choice, let me ask you this, if I had a choice between ruled by Muslims or Christians, sort of a trick question, which one I prefer? Do you think? Why? Back then. Okay, good. That's a good thing to add. Why would there be greater tolerance from Muslims toward Jews than from Christians toward Jews?
Because they were also the lesser man. Not the I forgot the word I'm looking for.
Right.
The minority. Thank you. That's the word.
Well, when you had a Christian majority, the Muslims were a minority. When you had a Muslim majority, Christians are a minority. Does it have to do something with the religions? They're all monotheistic religions.
They thought we were the enemy. They believe in the same God.
Don't they all three religions believe in the same God?
But Jesus believes in
God. Okay, well, I mean, again, I'm not going to get into Christian theology, but as far as the Christians or Catholicism is concerned, there's one God in three parts. I'm not getting into what that means exactly. But they certainly believe all in the same God. Okay, Islam, Christianity, Judaism believe in the same God, but
under the Muslims, weren't we considered like the protective people? Because like if we followed under the rules.
Okay, good. Under the Muslims, anyone know the term? By the way, the status.
Very good.
Vimis, very good. Mm-hmm. The Jews were and the Christians were considered a protected minority, people of the book. Right. Again, because they were monotheists, Islam traces itself to Christianity, and before that, to Judaism. So they weren't pagans, or Jews were not, or higher status than pagans. But Christianity comes to replace Judaism. That is, Jesus is the Messiah for whom?
The Jews.
The Jews. He's the Messiah of the Jews. And those who believe that Jesus is the Messiah should therefore convert and accept Jesus as the Messiah. But he's the Messiah of the Jews. So Christianity comes to replace Judaism. The true Israel, that's the term that Christianity uses, is now those who believe in Jesus. All right, the very short summary of that idea. For Islam, the Jews are the wrong religion, but they don't come to replace Judaism. Jews should have accepted Islam, certainly. But, you know, they believe in Abraham, they believe in Yeshayahu, they're all important prophets. Jesus also is a prophet as far as Islam is concerned. Judaism does not consider Jesus to be a prophet. So therefore, the antagonism toward toward Judaism is much greater from Christianity to Judaism than from Islam to Judaism. And therefore, Christians tended to treat Jews in a much worse way. In theory, Jews should be killed, according to Christianity, at least in theory. But then along came a good fellow named Augustine in the 4th century, 5th century, who said, we don't want to kill them, they should suffer, however, as a sort of testimony to what happens if you don't follow Jesus. So Jews shouldn't be killed, but they should suffer. He writes this, by the way, in a commentary in Tehillim. Okay. They should suffer. And therefore, that's what Christian rulers tended to do. And therefore, we look at page 2, we find that when the Arabs came to conquer Eretz Yisrael from the Byzantines, that is, the Christians, the Jews sided with the Muslims against the Christians. Let's just look a little bit here. The third line, when Heraclius, that is the Byzantine emperor, gathered his troops against the Muslims, and the Muslims learned that they were advancing upon them to do battle at the Yarmouk, that is in the northern part of Israel, the Muslims gave back to the people of Qims, the city, the tribute which they had taken from them. That is, even though the Muslims treated the Jews well, nonetheless, Jews and Christians had to pay special taxes, additional taxes that Muslims did not have to pay. They told them, the Muslims told the Christians, we are too preoccupied to aid and defend you, we have enough troubles of our own, you are on your own. But the people of Qims replied, we prefer your rule and your justice to the oppression and injustice in which we were formerly, as the Byzantines had conquered Eretz Yisrael from the Muslims, and now the Muslims are doing the same favor in return, and we should surely repair Heraclius' army from the city. Then the Jews drew up the next sentence, by the Torah, Heraclius' governor shall not enter the city unless we are vanquished, etc. And they locked the gates, and they defended against the Muslims. And by the way, when the Crusaders conquered Yerushalayim, we have eyewitness accounts of this, they didn't only kill Christians, they also killed a lot of Jews who were defending the city, okay, against the Christian invaders for the same reason. And again, the bottom of the page, this is a little bit later, Jews aided the Arabs in the conquest of Hebron. Again, the same idea. When the Arabs came to Hebron, they marveled at the strong and beautiful construction of its walls. There was no opening which they could enter it. Meanwhile, some Jews who had remained under the Greeks, Greeks means the Byzantines, in that region, came over to them and said, grant us security, though we have a similar status amongst you. May we be conceded the right to build a synagogue. All those things they didn't have under the Christians, they wanted to have under the Muslims. The Muslims said, fine, that's not a problem as far as we are concerned. They didn't quite look at religious toleration, but they did give Jews the rights to worship. The Christians had more of a problem with that. So the Jews, again, are a minority in the land of Israel. They are happier under the Muslims, and throughout most of this period, of course, the Muslims rule them. Thus, for example, number 3, the next page, Omar, who was the first Muslim caliph, the first a leader of the Muslims after Muhammad, in the 6th and 7th century, rather, he gave the Jews certain privileges, okay? Not equality, but certain privileges, and they could worship more or less as they wanted, and he's having a discussion there what to do. Let's go to the second paragraph. After this, the Jews sent word to all the rest of the Jews in Palestine to inform them of the agreement that Omar had made with them. The letter was sent back to them asking what would be the number of people who would be allowed to move to Jerusalem. The Christians had not allowed Jews to live in Yerushalayim. So they came into Omar's presence and asked him, how many people from the Jewish community will the commander of the faithful, that's the title given to Omar, order to move to the city? So he said, what will your enemies, the Christians, say? I got to worry about them too. He said, speak to them, and after that I shall have the final word, and we will put into the dispute between you. Omar wants peace between the people he's ruling. If the Christians are opposed to Jews living in Yerushalayim, he has a little problem. On the other hand, the Jews want to live in Yerushalayim. Then the Christian patriarch, the religious leader, and his entourage appeared, and Omar said to them, I've made an agreement with the Jews concerning all, where they can live, etc. Let there come here that number which you yourselves indicate. That is, you tell me how many. The patriarch responded, let the number of those who come with their family and their children be 50. The Jews replied, that is, we shall not be less than 200. They kept haggling over this. The Jews felt comfortable enough to argue, if you will, against what the Christians were saying so that Omar would agree. They kept haggling, and Omar commanded finally 70 households who now live. And interesting, next paragraph, that Omar said, where would you wish to live? In the southern part, they replied. And that is now the market of the Jews. The aim of their request to be near, of course, the Temple Mount and its gates, and likewise to be near the water of Silwan for ritual bathing. Where is the water of Silwan? Anyone know? Have you taken them on that teul? Through the Nikba? Oh, well, that's something to look forward to. There is a Yemei Shiloh, there is a Brecha, a spring there, and there's a very nice teul there as well. And they wanted to be near those, so they go to the mikveh. Okay? So that's why the Jews are located there. And from this time, in the 7th century, the Jews were living there under the Muslims. Again, not equality, but certainly not badly either. There were exceptions. If we turn over, this is one of a number of keynote, if you will, written by Jews who did suffer at various times under the Muslim, but it was rarer, certainly, than under the Christian. There were at various times extremists among the Muslims who were intolerant. We are somewhat familiar today with intolerant Muslims from time to time. It did not start then, although it was perhaps a little more exceptional at that time. And again, without going into detail here, the beginning of it, weep, my brothers, and mourn over Zion, all of us together, like the morning of Hadrijimon and Yoshiah, the son of Amon. He compares us to various other times when Jews were persecuted, and it talks about the weeping and the death, etc. We cannot be comforted, he says at the very end. There were times, indeed, when the Muslims did persecute the Jews, but for the most part, in the Middle Ages, they were relatively secure. Okay, they could worship, they could study Torah, they could earn a living, even if they were as someone earlier referred to them, as a tolerated minority, particularly in Yerushalayim. Okay. Now, if we go a little bit further, we have what I think is a rather fascinating document, number 5. It's fascinating for many reasons. Number 1, it is taken from something called the Cairo Geniza. Any know what the Geniza is? It is an archive. Why is it so special, so to speak? Why is it called the Geniza? Okay, that is, pull it out a little bit, yes?
Yes,
got it. I'm glad you know a lot there. Okay, go ahead.
That centuries of documents there.
Okay, and they were set aside because they were in Hebrew letters.
Yeah,
okay, right? We don't generally today put your average Israeli newspaper in the Shemes, right? But at that time, their custom among Jews in Muslim countries, particularly, and this was in Cairo, they would put anything in Hebrew letters, even your laundry list or your what to buy in the store, because if it was Hebrew, it was put aside, which was a gold mine, or is a gold mine for historians, because it has a tremendous number of things. Religious books, okay? We have things written by the Rambam himself, and also, mundane sort of things, which tells a lot about the Jewish community. Between about the 8th and 11th, 12th century. So it's extremely important. Now this document comes from the Cairo Geniza, and it tells us a very interesting thing. The Jews of Fustat, Fustat is the name for the old city of Cairo, where the Rambam lived, raised money to pay the taxes of their brethren in Yerushalayim. So this is sort of a thank you note okay, written by the head of the community in Yerushalayim to the Jews of the Stadt, thank you for paying taxes, helping us paying the taxes. Let's look at the third paragraph on the left. It is for this reason, that is the collection of taxes, the Arabs sit here as an imposition on the city. In other words, the Arabs know, Arabs meaning Muslims, know that the Jews want to be in Yerushalayim. They are a minority, and therefore they can be taxed more heavily. Imposing officials and fixed payments upon its men in return, that they, the Arabs, do not molest those of the house of Israel who come to seek atonement among its stones. That is, those Jews who come to pray, and on Ole Regal, if you will, on pilgrimages, they are allowed to do so because they pay extra. And he describes, they go pray in various places, next side of the page, who come to ascend the Mount of Olives with song and to stand there on holidays, face the shrine of the Lord, the Harabayit, etc., etc. Now the heavy tax, the end of line 3, is a fixed levy. We are but few in number. Now he comes to the Tachlis here. We have only enough to pay a small part of it. The remainder we have to borrow at interest, so the pilgrims to the Holy City will not be threatened with tax notices. In other words, the residents of Yerushalayim want to help the Jews who come on pilgrimage, so in order to do that, they have to pay taxes. Thus, he says, and this is a refrain that we are familiar with, it is duty for all Israel, no matter where they are, to support those who live in Jerusalem, to be a tent peg, if you will, a basis for them in time of need. Okay. So therefore, thank you very much, Jews of Sfat, and it's something that all Jews should do wherever they are. It's not the beginning of the custom, but it certainly is an extension of the custom. It shows, number one, who's a wealthier community? Fustat, Cairo, or Yerushalayim?
Fustat.
Obviously Fustat, right? The Jews under Islam there were relatively prosperous. In Yerushalayim, in Eretz Yisrael, was not quite the same, even those Jews did live there. Speaking about pilgrimages, turning over, there are many Jews who, in the Middle Ages, from Ashkenaz or Sfarad, were able to visit Eretz Yisrael. And their motivation was purely and simply religious. Most of them did not stay to dwell there. We'll talk about one or two exceptions. Perhaps the most famous is Yehuda Levi. This is just now my own curiosity. How many have read a poem by Yehuda Levi? Good. My faith in Jewish education has somewhat been restored, so thank you very much. The most famous, perhaps, is the one that appears here on page 11, Libi Mimizrach, Vanuchi Besos Ma'arav, my heart is in the east, and I in the uttermost west. And we know the story, that Yehuda Levi, according to the story in his old age, leaves Sfarad, leaves Spain, and goes to Eretz Yisrael. And the editor, if you will, here, quotes a famous story, written by, at the bottom of the page, Nagidaya ben Yosef, Ibn Yechia, Misaper al-Nesivot Motosh Rabbi Yehuda. He talks about the events surrounding the death of Yehuda Levi. Rabbi Yehuda Levi haya ben 50 shana kishalach l'Eretz Yisrael. V'kibalti mizakein echad, this is already in the 16th century, Yehuda Levi dies, let's say in the 11th century, shebegiyo el sharei Yerushalayim karad b'gadav, when he saw Yerushalayim, he tore his clothes, and he walked on his ankles or his legs as he approached the Harabayit. The Kayema Shinamar Kiratsua Vadayich et Avaneha Afura Yechonehu, the idea that one should come in the dust, so to speak, as you approach the Harabayit, because it is Bechur Bana. Vahaya Omer Akina, Shehu Chiber, and the Kina says, Haomer Etzion Halot Tishali, when do we read this particular Kina? Anyone know? Tisha B'Av, B'Yishmael Echad, according to the story, Lavash Kina Alav, he became zealous, that is angry at him, Meiro Deveikito, because the Jew was so enthusiastic, if you will, B'Halach Alav B'Susov Yirmasuv Yimiteu. According to the story, the Muslim horseman crushes Yehuda Levi as he is coming on his crawling to the Harabai. However, on the bottom of the page, Lagadazu ein hochacham mevuseset. There is no basis for this view. Imki lefi haolam imatzei haganiza nerash Yehuda Levi meit mavet lo tivi. That is, he may indeed have been killed, but the whole idea of his crawling and being killed, stomped by a Muslim horse, and we have absolutely no basis for that. Kenegad ha-sipur shel ha-parash yishmeili, opposed to this story about the Muslim knight, nitzavet ha-uvda shebotom yamim Eretz Yisrael nishata yidei ha-sabanim. There were no Muslims in Eretz Yisrael at the time. There were only crusaders. So it would be difficult for Yehuda Levi to be killed by a Muslim, a horseman. But again, so this is sort of a myth, okay? Now, the myth does not mean that it's absolutely wrong. But what is the purpose of a myth? We all have myths. Since almost all of you are Americans, except for one or two, I think, right? I don't know how many Canadians there are here. You know that the father of your country, George Washington, did not do what when he was such a young man? He did not... No, he chopped down the cherry tree, but did not lie about it. I doubt very much if George Washington chopped down a cherry tree, one or the other. But why is it that we have this myth?
It could be traced back to some type of truth, maybe.
Some type of what?
Like, there's some type of tree they're trying to be like.
I'm not sure it's connected to the tree, per se.
A good quality of him.
A good quality. In other words, the father of our country, father of the American's country, okay? If he didn't do it, he should have done it. In other words, only a person becomes the father of America would have this chut, the midah, not to lie about it. So similarly, Yehuda Levi, again, loud deal, Yehuda Levi, okay, who had this love for Eretz Yisrael and did leave in his old age to go to Eretz Yisrael, it is fitting that indeed such a terrible thing should have happened to him because it was the Galut, and you know, God gave him punishment now to give him glory and the reward in the next world. But it didn't quite, you know, historically probably is not true, but it establishes the love and the connection of great leaders and the Jewish people in general to Eretz Yisrael. It is an ideal, so to speak. Look what happened to Yehuda Levi. We also should be like that. And that is, I think, a very important idea of many of these sources, that it emphasizes our relationship and the connection of the Jewish people to land of Israel over the centuries. Similarly, another great personality with whom we are familiar in the next page is the Rambam. And we know the Rambam, born and lived in Spain. Most of his life he spent where? In Egypt. But before he went to Egypt, he did go to Eretz Yisrael briefly. Interestingly, he did not stay in Eretz Yisrael, which might be a halachic issue with some people. But whatever, the Rambam decided he wasn't staying in Eretz Yisrael, and he writes about it. Beleil echad b'shabbat b'arba yamim l'arech iyar nechnasti l'yam. He took a boat trip, and there was a great storm. He was almost killed. He prayed to Hashem, and he was saved. So about 10, we'll skip that part, about 10 lines down in the middle of the page. V'leil echad b'shabbat, everyone's with me. Shloshe amin l'erech sivan, yatsati min hayam b'shalom. In other words, we were saved from the storm. Ubanu l'ako, Akko being the main port of Eretz Yisrael. V'nitzalti min hashmad v'yiganu l'Eretz Yisrael. And I was saved from persecution. We had gotten to Eretz Yisrael. He was not alone. V'yom zen adarti she'e yom sason v'simcha u'mishteh u'matanot levyonim. Because he was saved, he therefore made a holiday, so to speak. Ani uveiti atzov kol dorot. That was a custom, especially among the Rambam's family, that they established various holidays, or on the contrary, fast days, as we'll see in a moment, for events that happen, and that is carried down through the generations. Ubiyom shlishi b'shabbat arba yamim li'erach machashvan shnat shisha v'yasrim li'tzirah. This is about 1165. Yatsanu me'ako lalotu yishalayim tachat sakana. We went there under great danger. Now, who is ruling the land of Israel at this time? It is the Crusaders. So it's not a good time to be traveling around. V'nechnasi levayit gadol v'akadosh v'palalti bo v'yom chamishi, the area probably of the Beit HaMikdash, next to the Beit HaMikdash, shisha yamim le'yerach ma'cheshvan. He's there very briefly. There is no community there. U'v'echad b'shabbat tisha b'chor yotzati m'yushalayim le'chevron. He goes to the holy places. L'nashe kivrei avotai b'ma'ra, m'rat ha'machpelah, v'oto yom manati b'ma'ra v'palalti shevach Lakel alako, Shnei Amim Ma'elu, Shehem, Shishivit, Shibi, Hashvan, Nadarti, Shuli, Kemo Yom Tov, Tfila, Simcha, Bashem, Vachla, Vishdia, Bigal, because he is there, but he leaves, okay, because there is no community, and he goes to Mitzrayim. So again, despite the challenges, despite what he described as a sakana, if you're a Jew and you're able to, you go to visit Eretz Yisrael. Again, he could not stay. He goes to Egypt. And of course, we know there is an idea, a halachic concept, of not returning to the land of Egypt because of all of the things the Egyptians did to us. But nonetheless, he goes to Egypt, and there's a large and prosperous Jewish community there. The Rambam just gives us a little piece of his experience. Another Jew who went to Eretz Yisrael is a fellow named Binyamin Mitudela. Okay, again, I'm not sure anyone's familiar with him. Where is Tudela? It is a city in northern Spain. And Binyamin is not a Tamil Chacham. Binyamin is a rich merchant. And towards the end of his life, he decides it's a good idea to travel around the Jewish world and visit the Jewish communities. And he can do so because he is a rich merchant. And luckily for us, he also keeps a diary, and it was called in English an itinerary. And he describes a little bit about each of the communities. So he's one of the more important sources for the Jewish communities in the Middle Ages. And just briefly, top of the page, Misham Shalosh Pirsaot, from the last place he was, a certain distance to Yerushalayim, he irk tana, there are many people there. It is a fortified city. Here is ruled by the Muslims. That's the main people. And there are others, Yaakovim, Arimim, etc., etc. Dying, D-Y-E. The Jews were given the right to be the only dyers, which apparently was a relatively prosperous occupation. Shikonim oto hayudim b'chol shana min ha-melech. Shlo yaseh shum adam tzviyah b'Yushalayim ki im hayudim levadam. So the Jews had the sole right of being dyers in Yerushalayim, which provided them with an income. Of course, they had to pay the ruler a tax. And without going into the details here, he describes the city and the Jewish community. Look at where it says on the right side, Lamed Vav. We'll just skip to there in the middle of the line. V'yesh b'Yerushalayim arba'ah sharim. There are four gates. Shar Avraham, Shar David, Shar Tzion, Shar Noshafat, Hu Shar Yehoshafat, Lesnei Beit HaMikdash, Shayav Yimei Kerem, V'sham Min Puli Dumini, that's the Christian name, V'haya Makom Mikdash. Ubana Lav, Amar Ben El Katav, the same Amar we talked about a little while ago, Kippa Gedola V'yafa. In other words, they built the Kippa, right, the Dome of the Rock. Why is the Dome of the Rock holy to the Jews? Why is that area, I should say, holy to the Jews?
Makom HaMikdash.
Makom HaMikdash, what happened there originally? First, the Akedah. Why is it holy to the Muslims? Right, according to tradition, Muhammad goes up to heaven. It has no particular holiness to the Christians, except perhaps Beit HaMikdash. Otherwise, it is only holy to the Muslims and the Jews. And he builds this large structure, which we see today, right? It is essentially the same structure. It's been refurbished from time to time, but it's the same structure. And Benjamin tells us about this. There are about 300 Jews in Yerushalayim. They are mainly in the dyeing business, D-Y-E again. And we see that there is a community. Community goes to and from, right? It develops, it ebbs, but the Jews are persistent in their attempts to be in Yerushalayim. One or two others, turning to page number 9, to source number 9, the Ramban. Okay? And the Ramban also goes through Yerushalayim towards the end of his life. Where does the Ramban live?
Spain.
In Spain. And why does he leave Spain? Anyone know?
Persecution?
Exile. No, this is long before the Spanish Inquisition. There was a disputation. Which the Ramban was forced to participate with the Christians, and he had the chutzpah of winning the disputation, and they tried to disprove various things about Judaism, or to prove things about Christianity, and he had the protection of the king, and the Ramban, which was he was not given permission to do, wrote it down in a document called Vikuach HaRamban, which is readily available, I'm sure, here as well, and a fascinating document to read. Because he published this, he published it in order to give strength to the Jewish community, they should realize the superiority of Judaism, he had to leave. And he is about in his late 60s, and he goes to Eretz Yisrael, arrives in 1267, he only lives 3 more years. But during that period, he develops the community. Right? He gives it some sort of basis. In the first paragraph, which I won't go through, he talks about going to the Har HaBayit, and it is covered with thorns, and there are worms, and there are all kinds of animals walking around, and he's not too happy about that. But he still decides to stay. Yud Aleph, in the middle of the page, B'Yushalayim Yir HaKodesh Ani Kotev Elecha Sifri Zeh. This is his parish on Torah, actually. Ki Shemach Hoda'a L'Tzu Yishi Zachiti U'Bati L'Shalom B'Yom Tshi L'Yerech Elul V'Manati Ba'al L'Shalom Ad Machrat Yom HaKippurim. Asher Panei Mo'adot L'Lecha L'Chevron. That is, he goes also just like the Rambam, Yushalayim, and then Chevron, so also he. Ir ha'kvarot avoteinu lishtatech b'negdam latziv li sham kever berzat Hashem. Uma agid lachem binyan ha'aretz, what can I tell you? Ki rabah azuva v'gadal ha'shamimon. It is a destroyed land. Klal shadavor kol ha'mkudash mechavero cherev yoter mechavero, charav yoter mechavero. The holier the place, the more it is destroyed. Yushalayim yoter chareva min hakol, v'eretz Yehuda yoter min hagalil, v'imkol chorbana hi tovamo. But he says, even though it is destroyed, nonetheless, it is very good. Eretz Yisrael. V'yoshveh ha'karov le'alpayim v'notzrim b'tocham k'shlosh miot plitim mecherv ha'shultan, v'ein Yisrael b'tocham ki me'et ba'o ha'tatarim. That is, in Yushalayim, at this point, there are almost no Jews. The Tatars came and chased them out. Umehem shenehargu b'chorbam. Again, but rak shnei achim tzva'im. But there are two dyers there. Konim atzvia min ha'moshel, and that's how he begins to develop the community. There's the yeshiva. Again, not a great yeshiva, but there's a place where Jews learn and study. It reflects again the effort to rebuild the land of Israel. The Ramban's love for Israel is well known. Believes that you should Eretz Yisrael is a mitzvah, okay, unlike the Rambam. And we also have, interestingly, the signet ring of the Ramban on the bottom of the page, which was discovered. You see Moshe Bar Nachman Girondi. He traces it back to his birthplace in Gerona in northern Spain. So the Ramban is an important element in the history of Yerushalayim during the Middle Ages. It reflects, again, this dedication, this connection to the land. Okay, I'm not going to go through all of these. Next one deals with the Bartanura. Who is the Bartanura? What did he write that's important to you?
Perish
HaMishnayot, etc. Very good. And if you go to Tveria on page 16, in the 17th century, there was an attempt to develop Tveria. This is after the expulsion. Dan Yosef and his aunt go there. They try to develop an industry. Anyone know what the industry was? A silk industry. What do you need to make silk?
Worms.
Worms, right? Swarms, silk worms, and mulberry trees, because apparently the worms eat the mulberry trees, the leaves. And it is unsuccessful, but nonetheless, again, there's an attempt to develop Tveria. So what do we see? We see during the Middle Ages, this time that we tend not to focus upon as much, that there were, first of all, a continuous connection of the Jewish people to the land of Israel, and that there were various attempts to return, to emphasize that connection, not really developing the land very much. And under the Ottoman Turks from the 16th century to, let's say, beginning of the 20th century, World War I, a particular last period, Eretz Yisrael is Shamema. It is lacking in population, both Jewish and otherwise. It is desolate. There is very little industry, which is more or less what the Jews found when they came in the 18th century. Right? Hasidim, the year 1700, a group of them came, and then the Zionists in the 19th century. The land was pretty much desolate. It had a population. Okay, let's remember that. there was a population in the land of Israel, not a very large Jewish population, but certainly a population, which one has to relate to as well. So in 1700, there were about 200 Jews Ashkenazic Jews who came, making the population about 1,200 in total. In 1800, there were about 300,000 about 5,000 Jews, and that's from that, of course, which is not much in terms of numbers, develops what we know as Eretz Yisrael, Medinat Yisrael, to this very day. Without what we have talked about today, the emphasis on this connection to Eretz Yisrael, none of that would have happened. We are used to Israel, to the state of Israel, to the land of Israel. We see nothing wrong and normal to jumping on a plane and coming to Israel. Most of your family, perhaps, parents, etc., have been to the land of Israel. But understand that only about 20% of North American Jews have ever been to the land of Israel. That's it. I was the first one in my family, my generation, to go to the land of Israel. My parents came after me, etc., grandparents, etc., never came to the land of Israel. So we somehow take it for granted. The Jews we read about, talked about today, they have not taken it for granted. They did not take it for granted. They realize and appreciate the importance of Eretz Yisrael, and we should look at them as our model and keep it in our minds when we go through and walk through the streets of Yerushalayim and other places in Eretz Yisrael. Thank you.